Welcome to Awesome Movie Year, the podcast where we take a look back at an awesome year for movies, which is every year. My name is Josh Bell, film critic and writer, and I'm joined by my co-host.
Frankenstein from the town of Frankenstein.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you, Jason. In case we didn't know what we were doing here.
I mean, there's a Dr. Frankenstein. Everyone thinks the monster's called Frankenstein. The village is Frankenstein. There's a lot of Frankenstein in this
film. There is indeed a lot of Frankensteins in this film. In our season on the films of 1939, we're here at our future cult classic pick, and it is Son of Frankenstein, the third movie in the Universal Frankenstein series that began with James Whale's Frankenstein, followed by Bride of Frankenstein, also directed by James Whale. And he did not return for this third film, Son of Frankenstein, directed by Roland V. Lee. But we do have the final appearance from Boris Karloff as Frankenstein's monster. And I think they do capitalize on the fact that the name Frankenstein is now very well known as this franchise. And having seen those other movies, the town was not called Frankenstein in the previous films. And it just now is, right?
I mean, there's no Igor before this one either. And we all think of Igor as just such a seminal piece of this kind of lore.
Right, exactly. So this is a film that, despite losing that original director with that vision, it does establish some kind of essential elements of this franchise and this whole sort of pop culture conception of Frankenstein that we have in so many movies, including Igor, the devious hunchbacked, or he's not really hunchbacked, but he's hunchnecked or something, the assistant.
I think it's a little of both. I mean, he's hanged, he's got a bolt in his neck, he's got a lot of, he could go for a chiropractor adjustment.
He needs something going on. Bela Lugosi, who really steals the show here in this film as Igor. But not only did the original director not return, but none of the original actors, aside from Boris Karloff, returned for this film. We have Basil Rathbone as the son of Dr. Frankenstein, who was originally played by Colin Clive in the first two films. And Colin Clive actually passed away, so he was not available anyway for this film. And
unless they Frankenstein.
Yeah, they could have done that. That would have been some real method acting if he was a revived corpse to star in this film. This was put into production in part because of re-releases of other Universal horror films, including Frankenstein, had done really well at the box office. It eventually had a budget of $420,000. Although, again, as has been the case in many episodes this season, I couldn't find specific box office figures other than vague references to it being a box office success. And the fact that this franchise then continued is, I think, an indication of that.
Well, not just that. Universal had stopped making monster movies for a couple of years, and then this kind of restarted the whole thing. 1936 with Dracula's Daughter, they said, that's it. Marvel, you should take a cue. And then after the success of they're back at it, Josh.
Yeah, so back Marvel at it. Marvel shouldn't take a cue because, of course, they then made increasingly bad movies and eventually just petered out this whole Universal Monster franchise. But this one was a success. And I think this is, having seen many movies in the Universal horror canon, as well as specifically the Frankenstein franchise, this is kind of the last gasp of quality of these Universal Frankenstein films. And it was really, really all downhill from here.
Mm, that's too bad. What was the one from Frankenstein? Ghost of Frankenstein was next.
Yes,
right?
Ghost of Frankenstein was the next one after this. But Boris Karloff did finally bow out of playing the monster. This was his final appearance as the Frankenstein monster. So
and then Lon Chaney replaced.
Yes, Lon Chaney, and then Bela Lugosi himself played the monster later. So and then many different actors over the course of the next many decades. But this movie definitely was not a high point per se for this franchise, but I think kind of the last, moment of quality or whatever. And critics were relatively positive, or I think we got some kind of backhanded compliments for this that we get sometimes here from critics. So B.R. Chrysler or Chrysler from the New York Times said about this film, "No use beating around the raspberry bush. If Universal's Son of Frankenstein isn't the silliest picture ever made, it's a sequel to the silliest picture ever made, which is even sillier. But its silliness is deliberate, a very shrewd silliness perpetrated by a good director in the best traditions of cinematic horror, so that even while you laugh at its nonsense, you may be struck with the notion that perhaps that's as good a way of enjoying oneself at a movie as any. It must have been all the actors themselves could do in this day and age to keep straight faces, always excepting poor Boris Karloff, of course, who couldn't laugh through all that makeup even if he tried."
Yeah, I disagree with all of that. I don't think there's any silliness, and I think they all play this like in the right tone. So I don't know what you want from that. I mean, the only thing I'll agree with is Karloff said one of the reasons he stopped doing this was because of the exhaustion he had from being in makeup all the time, and also that the makeup was the star. There wasn't much more he could do with this character.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Karloff's performance is literally just lying unconscious on a table in this film. I mean, the monster himself isn't revived until, I think, what, about
30 minutes in.
Yeah, or even more. And, you know, it's like when we talked about Gulliver's Travels and Gulliver was unconscious for half the movie or whatever. It definitely...
Frankenstein versus Gulliver?
Frankenstein, yes. That is definitely a possibility, right? Did we have Gulliver? Was Gulliver going to fight King Kong or something? Who did we come up with when we
talked about... We rebooted the entire Universal monster franchise. Gulliver meets the Wolfman, yeah. Abbott and Costello go with Gulliver to faraway lands. We got the whole thing going here.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Gulliverstein.
Gulliverstein. Considering the permutations the Frankenstein story has taken in, you know, the subsequent decades, I would not put Gulliverstein past any filmmaker here, really. But I mean, I will say, like, you're right that all the actors are playing this straight, but there is silly stuff in this film. I mean, Lionel Atwill's character, the inspector, who has this ridiculous, like, fake arm that keeps popping up like Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove or whatever. Like, it is a bit silly, right?
I mean, they ripped the Frankenstein monster ripped his arm off, Josh. Well, so, you know.
Right. But the way that they showcase the things that he does with the fake arm and the little, like, he's always pulling stuff out of his sleeve. And, you know, when he plays darts with Baron Frankenstein, he puts the, like, darts in his fake arm so that he can hold on to them. I mean, it's kind of goofy.
I mean, at that point, the movie ran out of steam there. That it really falls flat before we get to the big climax.
I'm just saying that there are ridiculous elements that are entertaining because they're played straight.
Okay.
All right. You don't have to agree. So Variety, in their unbylined review, said, "Typical chiller, developed on regulation formula. Son of Frankenstein will attract substantial business in those houses where audiences like their melodrama strong and weird. Most of the surprise elements necessary for a shocker are utilized to build audience suspense. There are secret passages and panels, surprise opening of doors, and well-timed sound effects to further create tense interest. Photography is held at low-key lighting, employing several shadow effects to further spooky and weird reactions. For offering of its type, picture is well-mounted, nicely directed, and includes cast of capable artists."
I think it's a little better than that. I mean, I thought it looked great. Like, the mood was really set. The lighting and the shadows I definitely took note of. And I just thought they really set a nice, eerie, gothic tone there.
Yeah, I mean, this movie does look great. It doesn't look like the other two Frankenstein movies. I mean, if you want to talk about, like, continuity or something like that, the castle that Baron Frankenstein, that Basil Rathbone supposedly inherits in this film, looks nothing like the home of Dr. Frankenstein from the previous two films. But it looks great. It has this sort of, like, M.C. Escher-esque, you know, weird angles, and, like, things don't particularly fit together, but it makes it seem super off kilter, and the lighting does add to that. So I agree, the visual style here is fantastic.
And the lab away from everything, you know, it all works for me. Josh, those first two movies, they weren't living in Frankenstein, and now they're living in Frankenstein. So of course it's going to look different.
I mean, it is meant to be the same place, even though they have somehow renamed it like retroactively between films.
I mean, you know, after Dr. Frankenstein and the first one created this monster, who murdered a little girl. You know, what else could they do but rename the town after him?
Although, again, I don't think they did. They seem like the opposite, that they would want to rename the town something else, right? Because they're trying to repudiate the Frankenstein legacy, but they just don't.
But now this will always be a reminder. Don't let this happen again.
Don't create monsters who kill people. A lesson not learned by the main character in this film.
Right. And easily forgettable unless you name your town after it.
I suppose that's true. Yeah. So finally, Basil Wright in The Spectator was not a fan of this film. He said, films which set out to be frightening and gruesome seldom succeed in getting beyond the turnip and sheet stage of horror. Anxious, no doubt, to give full value in shrieks to the largest possible audience, the producers lay everything on with a trowel, from the heavy shadows that strike across the castle corridors to the inches-deep mascara on Karloff's long-suffering face. Many of the sets are quite brilliant, reminiscent of Dr. Caligari. Slashed with crooked staircases and slanting beams, they attain of themselves some degree of suspense, which is only shattered by the intrusion of clumpingly realistic actors and actresses. Son of Frankenstein is, in short, a missed opportunity for all save the most unsophisticated.
Well, consider me the most unsophisticated then, Josh.
Oh, I do.
Okay.
But no, I think this is wrong. And the idea that the problem with this movie is that the acting is too realistic, I think is really missing the boat here entirely.
Yeah, again, we just talked about this in the last episode. You know, you have to play it as if it's happening, because if not, then what's the point of doing it?
Right, but I think also these performances aren't so like naturalistic or something. I mean, Bela Lugosi as Igor is totally hamming it up in this movie. And in an enjoyable way, he's giving exactly the performance that he should be.
I agree. I mean, you know, look, he's an assistant to a doctor who's robbing graves and putting brains into people and creating monsters. What do you want him to do on this? You know, play it like he's in Before Sunrise?
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe that was what they wanted. So had you had not seen this, right, Jason? Were you familiar at all with the Frankenstein franchise?
Never heard of it, Josh. Never even heard of it. No, I had never seen these original three. Obviously, I've seen other Frankensteins and, of course, Young Frankenstein, which, as you mentioned to me in our little chat, you could see all of the imprints on that film from this film, right? But I had never watched these original monster movies.
Yeah, I had seen this one as well as, I mean, like I said, the entire Frankenstein franchise and a number of other Universal horror movies before. And I think the first time that I watched this movie, I was going through, I had on my blog at joshbellhateseverything.com at one point several years ago, maybe even like 10 or more years ago now, done a whole like month of posts about Frankenstein movies. And so I was going through in succession watching these films, and I had just seen the James Whale movies relatively soon before this. And I think this suffers in comparison, but watching it now just on its own, I think I was better able to appreciate the strengths that it has away from those films.
It's interesting because I watched this and then went back and watched the James Whale, the original Frankenstein, and I'm going to watch Bride of Frankenstein, but I haven't gotten there yet. But I like this one better than Frankenstein.
Yeah, all right. So, Dave, had you seen this or any of these classic Frankensteins before?
So, actually, in the first year of piecing it together, one of our first ever Breaking It Aparts was on the original Frankenstein. With Breaking It Apart, we do the piecing it together format backwards, look at an older movie and what it inspired. So, I had just watched that about, what's that, like 5-6 years ago now. But I had never seen any of the other Frankenstein movies, so I watched Bride of Frankenstein and this back-to-back. And it was fun seeing the varying tones between these three movies.
Right. I mean, and also the continuity of this franchise is not exactly strong. I mean, as we're saying, I mean, we mentioned the renaming of the town and the fact that the whole castle and lab and everything look completely different. But really, anything that happened in Bride of Frankenstein is kind of swept aside here. And I guess the original draft of this screenplay from the writer who's credited, Willis Cooper, did include more references specifically to the Bride of Frankenstein and to Dr. Pretorius, who is Frankenstein's kind of mentor slash rival in that film. But those references were all cut out. And it's a shame because Elsa Lanchester, who plays the Bride of Frankenstein and really has that like iconic look or whatever that people know, but she shows up for just like a minute or two at the end of the Bride of Frankenstein film. And it's too bad that she didn't get a real showcase for that character, who is completely just erased from this franchise entirely here.
I haven't seen it, but of course, I'll just agree with you, Josh. But, you know, in this new version, you know, the monster was originally supposed to speak and there was no Igor in that script. So it's a trade-off because you got to have the Igor, baby.
Yeah, Igor is great. Of course, Igor then is another continuity adjustment because he talks as if he was always the assistant to the original Dr. Frankenstein and helped him procure bodies and all this stuff. But of course, he had never appeared in the previous films. There were different assistant characters who were not really like this at all. And so, but you're right, Jason, we want him in this movie because he's very entertaining. And the monster speaking is something that is in the book and is in some versions of Frankenstein, but Karloff had really established this character in that kind of grunting, lumbering way. And that's, I think, what people expected from him.
I think he does a really good job with that.
Yeah. I mean, with the limited range of what he can do, he does express, I don't know if you want to say he expresses emotions, but he expresses sort of motivations, maybe.
Monstrous instincts.
Right, right. He has this like affinity for the younger Frankenstein, seems to maybe recognize some of his father in him or whatever we could say, I suppose.
Well, maybe he'll try to throw him off of a windmill.
Right. I don't know if it's affinity or he's got a complicated relationship to the whole Frankenstein family, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, they gave him life, but they don't treat him all that well. No, all the time.
Not so much. So anything else you want to mention about the background of this film, Jason?
You know, there was so much of this script that either wasn't written or wasn't used that we keep mentioning Bela Lugosi. And Lugosi was just kind of there on set, and they just gave him more and more to do. And kind of helped him find that characterization. And he always thanked Roland Lee for like kind of restarting his career and getting him paid for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great showcase for him. And if it was developed on set and giving him more to do and really bringing that character out, it was totally worth it because as great as Karloff is and as definitive as his portrayal is of the Frankenstein monster, Lugosi is what really sells this film.
Roland V. Lee said of Lugosi that the crew let him work on the characterization. The interpretation he gave us was imaginative and totally unexpected. When we finished shooting, there was no doubt in anyone's mind that he stole the show, which I agree with. But then he said Karloff's monster was weak by comparison, which I don't agree with.
Yeah, I mean, I think by comparison, it's fair to say, and it's not that Karloff doesn't do a good job, but that he's really so much of the focus in those earlier films. And the focus here is more on Igor.
And why not? Let him cook, baby.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. He's great here. So we'll come back in a moment and talk more of our general thoughts on Son of Frankenstein. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1939, we are talking about our future cult classic pick, Son of Frankenstein. And so, Jason, as a newcomer to this Universal Frankenstein series, you thought this was a good start for you?
I think it was a really good start. You know, like I said, you got that kind of creepy, eerie feeling. You know, in my research, obviously, they alluded to German expressionism. But I, you know, to me, it's that gothic tone and that kind of the score, the look, the shadows. It's a real monster movie. It's the type of thing that I think, you know, if they put it in the theaters now, you could probably take the family out to have some popcorn and watch a society destroy a monster that they created.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what happens when society creates a monster. Yeah, I mean, the review from The Spectator references Dr. Caligari, and that's German expressionism, and definitely stuff like those weird canted angles and pieces of furniture or pieces of the house that look like they don't fit together, or the beds that are at some angle. And I love that scene where Frankenstein's wife comes in and she asks the maid, like, why are the beds set up that way? And the maid's like, oh, it's a local superstition about that. Yeah, that's the reason. Totally. Yeah, makes sense.
And no, I marked that down. I thought that was cool. If the house is filled with dread, then place the beds head to head.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not like a real thing. It's more that Roland Lee and the production designer thought it would look cool if the beds were like that, and then kind of came up with a reason for it afterwards.
Well, they did a lot of good stuff. You know, you're talking about the angles and the way the light reflects off of some of those angles and just how jagged this castle is. So I think they really use the setting to the advantage here.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's the great like dining room where it's like, why would anyone want to eat their meals in this room with these looming things over them? And then this barren room that has just this table in the middle and is otherwise completely sparse. And nothing looks like that in reality if it's not a movie set.
Right. You know, we talk a lot in this season kind of like about backgrounds and set backgrounds. Man, the lightning, the matte painting on the lightning was awesome in this thing. It really, really enhanced the feel. And I think that it just really gave such a creepy kind of element to the setting. I just love that.
Yeah, the matte paintings look great as we go through the town, or as Frankenstein walks over to his laboratory and we see that sort of set against the sky and the hill or mountain or whatever that the laboratory is on. All of those really look fantastic. And that builds the atmosphere. And I think when you have that environment, you can let the actors give these somewhat big performances because you've created the proper place for them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they could have done a better job with the set. The mansion, the laboratory, everything kind of worked for me. Frankenstein's death really looked good at the end of this, the monster's death. Spoiler alert, the monster dies in Frankenstein, Josh. If you've ever seen a Frankenstein film, this is not a spoiler.
Yeah, the monster always dies and then always comes back. He died at the end of the last movie, and he's just there chilling at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah, this one, he falls into this like bubbling tar pit, and it's
sulfur.
Really looked good.
It's a sulfur.
Oh, sulfur, right. Because they built this laboratory on the sulfur baths that Romans used as a health resort. I love like the kind of mythology to this thing.
Right. Those sulfur baths, not in the previous movies. they were just apparently unmentioned.
That's because they hadn't moved to Frankenstein yet, Josh. I keep telling you.
Yeah. So. But yeah, that is great where they're like, oh yeah, here's an explanation for why that is. And then Lionel Atwell's character, the inspector, says, maybe you can show me the lab. And, you know, Frankenstein's just like, maybe I'll parboil you sometime. Ha, 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 ha.
Man, you got that one, Josh.
No, it's great. I feel like Basil Rathbone has that, like, I mean, he's overshadowed, of course, by Karloff and Lugosi, but he really gets that perfect tone for this Frankenstein character. And he's weirdly sarcastic like that, right? And I do love that where, you know, the inspector is increasingly on to what's going on with the monster and is accusing of things. And his strategy is to just kind of deflect with snark, like, oh yeah, I revived my father's monster and he killed people. Sure, I totally did that. And he totally did do that.
Well, you know, that's a classic, like, hey, do you like so-and-so in fifth grade? Oh yeah, I have such a crush on so-and-so. She's my dream girl. Josh, he's good, Basil Rathbone, in this one. I think you're right, you know, obviously. But like, he really has that kind of mania of like, I have to restore my family's name, you know, and I must carry on my father's work, right? Like, I think he really goes all in on that.
Right. And it is great, though, because he shows up with the idea that he wants to restore his family's name to respectability, right? He even complains on the train ride into the town in a kind of meta reference, like, oh, even 9 out of 10 people will call the monster Frankenstein, right? Which is, of course, a thing that had already been happening in pop culture. And yet he makes this shift at some point very easily away from like, oh, my father did terrible things and I need to rehabilitate his name, to like, well, maybe I'll just keep doing the terrible things that my father did. It'll work out this time somehow.
Hey, man, when you create a Frankenstein monster, what else can you do, Josh?
Yeah, well, he doesn't even create the monster. He just
recreates the monster.
Revives the monster. Igor is the one who has been kind of keeping the monster around to do his bidding. And
he reanimates the monster?
Yeah, he does.
Frankenstein versus Reanimator?
Well, that could exist. Reanimator, of course, is inspired, you know, largely by these Frankenstein films. I think one of many that is inspired that way. But yeah, so Igor really is using the monster as kind of like a tool for taking revenge against the people who wronged him.
Right. So, you know, Igor, the story is he was the father's assistant. They created this monster. They killed the monster. And then they decided to hang Igor, right? And they hanged him. And he has got this great line because he's got like this bolt in his neck. And
it's not a bolt. It's a bone that's like sticking out.
Oh, right. Okay. So the bone's in his neck. And he goes, they die death. I die life. I just thought that such a good line.
It's great. And so he's taking revenge against the eight men who were on, I guess, like the jury that convicted him.
Right.
And I love how he's sitting in the I don't know if it's the courthouse or like the town hall or whatever. And there's the burgomaster who's like the mayor of the town.
It's not a town hall or a courthouse. It's a Frankenstein.
Yeah, everything is a Frankenstein. They're sitting there and they're sort of like debating what's going on. And the burgomaster or whatever, the judge or whoever it is basically like, well, we already killed him. So we can't possibly do that again. Like it's a legal loophole that because he survived the hanging, he's now like legally dead and thus can never be convicted of a crime.
Double indemnity, man.
Yeah.
It does not seem right. It does not seem right.
I feel like if you survive a hanging, you should just get to go on and live your life.
I mean, that's clearly the way that the laws of the town of Frankenstein are set up because Igor is able to just run amok here. And also they're very naive because they're like, somehow, mysteriously, only the people who were on the jury that convicted Igor have died. And the two ones who are left, they're like, oh, I also was on that jury. Yes, I was too. What a strange coincidence. I'm sure we'll be fine.
Oh, yeah. So a little convenient on the lack of, putting the next piece of the puzzle together for those two. But, I love that. Also, like, it's a motivated revenge for him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he has a clear reason. He's not just killing indiscriminately. And I mean, Igor seems a bit demented. But on the other hand, he's not just a psycho killer.
No, that, of course, would be Talking Heads. And Josh, this is Frankenstein, so we're talking about the Edgar Winter Band here.
Mm, yeah, another good Frankenstein reference that you got going there.
Josh, one other line that I loved of this, it just when they're talking about Frankenstein and they're saying like, you know, his father was Dr. Frankenstein, they go, his mother was Lightning.
Right? I mean, I guess that so seems like Dr. Frankenstein fucked the lightning, right? Is that what you're trying to imply there?
No, that's what you're taking from it. But that's okay. I just thought it was a great line.
There is one point, and maybe this is like Wolf Frankenstein. His name is Wolf, by the way. Basil Rathbone's character is talking about another retcon here where he's like, oh yeah, my father, he thought he was harnessing lightning, but it was really cosmic rays and has turned the monster into this sort of like superhuman. And he talks about how, you know, his heart or whatever is bigger and his blood pressure or whatever. And it's like his giant cock. And I don't know if that was on purpose. It probably wasn't, but it stood out to me.
Well, if you're gonna fuck lightning, you might as well have a giant caucus.
Right. Mm-hmm. So true.
Dave, you love movies. What do you think of this one?
Yeah, no, I loved how it looked. I thought it just looked so damn cool, all of these shots. And, I loved Igor so much. He's so much fun to watch. I thought that this kind of just slid in between the other two Frankenstein movies I had watched, like as far as like how much I liked it. I thought there were stretches of this that got a little bit kind of, meandering a little bit, like just a little boring. But, generally, though, I did like the movie.
So you said it's in between the other two. Yeah. What is one and what is three?
I mean, the first one's a classic. I would keep it in the first spot, you know?
I like this better than Frankenstein. Yeah. I thought Frankenstein, the first one, which was like 70 minutes, you really don't get, again, the Frankenstein to come in until like 30 minutes. And then there's another 20 minutes where he doesn't do anything. This one, it takes 30 minutes, but I think the setting's cooler. And once he gets going, he gets going.
I mean, I think the thing about the original is that, you know, we now know Karloff's performance and everything about the Frankenstein monster that is so iconic. But of course, that wasn't the case then. And they're adapting Mary Shelley's novel where Dr. Frankenstein really is the focus. He's the main character. He's the person that we pay attention to. So it makes sense, even though it's a very loose adaptation, that they're building that and that they're thinking that's what the story is about. And it's only after that movie came out and the response to it that it was like, oh, we got to make Karloff the star.
Yeah.
So this is why Josh is a pro, because when I was watching it, I was like, okay, I get this as like a blueprint going forward, right? Felt more like a kind of spine of where things could go than a fully fledged picture.
Right. I mean, and I, you know, I've read the novel a couple times. That's definitely a favorite, although I haven't read it in a long time. And, you know, again, it's a loose adaptation. The monster in the book talks like a lot and is very articulate. And that's not the case in any of these movies and in many going forward either.
And how do you rank the three, Josh?
Well, it's like I said, it's been a little while. I did rewatch Bride of Frankenstein slightly more recently. So I would, my instinct is to rank the original at the top and like basically just rank them in order. But I'd have to rewatch those other two again to be sure. But I did like this more, I think, like I said, on this rewatch. Not that I didn't like it before, but I thought its strengths were more apparent as I was watching it here, not having just watched those others.
A lot of technical strengths with, like we said, the set, the design. Dave, you want to talk about the cool music that they've used a billion times since this picture, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic score, but yeah, I mean, it's all of that production design, cinematography score, all of that coming together. It's, you know, it all paints such a great picture here. But yeah, I mean, they're two and three, Bride and Son, are so different from one another, like tone wise, that like they're almost on even ground as far as how much I like them. It's just kind of two different things.
Yeah, Bride of Frankenstein is so weird. And you can see that that's James Whale, who was reluctant to come back and was like, all right, fuck it. You want me to make a new Frankenstein movie? I'm going to make the weirdest thing you could possibly imagine. This is what you get. And Roland Lee is coming in here as an outsider and as kind of this journeyman director and is doing, I mean, it's good, but it's definitely a lot more like, hey, let's make a monster movie, straightforward kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the entire saga of Ant-Man all over again, Josh.
Sure. So, I mean, Jason, you mentioned there was some, what did you think didn't work about this film?
Well, before that, Josh, I was excited to talk to you about Donnie Dungan, who played Peter von Frankenstein, the little kid. I thought he was great. And I know you hate kids and their acting abilities. This kid nailed that part.
Donnie Dungan. Yeah, no, he's so annoying in this movie.
It's great.
And I mean, there's actually, like, even Donnie Dungan himself said that this performance, the direction that he was given was to just be louder. And he said that what happened was as like the louder he was, the more his like accent came out. It does not sound like the son of Frankenstein here. He sounds like some, you know, some kid from middle America, which is what he was. And he just really does not fit, but whatever.
Nah, he's good.
Kudos to Donnie Dungan. yeah. So were there aspects of this movie you didn't like, though?
Well, so Dave kind of mentioned it and I kind of mentioned it. So when everything ramps up and like the inspector figures everything out and like the quote unquote chase is on, they really, really stall to finish that chase. You mentioned that dart scene. And at this point, Dr. Frankenstein is like, well, we'll just play darts instead, you know, and it's like, it's just filler. It doesn't add anything. And in fact, it just subtracts till we get to that big climax. So that definitely took it down for me a notch.
Yeah, it is a little slow. I mean, this is the longest of the Frankenstein movies. It's 99 minutes, which is a bit long for these kinds of horror B movies or whatever. I agree that some of that does feel like a stalling tactic, but at the same time, I love the menacing way that Dr. Frankenstein plays darts. Like, we're in the middle of all of this stuff and he's just like tossing the darts over and over and over again, and like not even looking half the time. And it was just such an odd thing to do that I kind of liked it. And of course, the bit where Lionel Atwill, where the inspector, when he it's time for him to throw the darts, he's like, where do I put the darts while I wait to throw them? Oh, I'm just going to stab them into my fake arm here. I do love that.
That is good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just out of place a little bit, I'd say.
Yeah, I guess so. So I just want to, you know, give another shout out to Lionel Atwill, because I feel like that's such a oddball character, and he really throws himself into that part.
Yeah, I really liked him in that as well. And I was glad that his arm got, once they mentioned that the arm got ripped off, like at the beginning, I'm like, man, they got to rip either the fake arm off or the real arm off. And they delivered on that promise. Real Chekhov moment. Show the gun in act one, shoot it by act three.
Chekhov's arm. So yeah, at least it was the fake arm that got ripped off. I'd feel, you know, it'd be really unfortunate for him if his other like working arm was ripped off and then he had no arms.
Little Monty Python action. Yeah.
That's not really what they're going for. Although, can we talk about, I want to talk about the ending, like the epilogue, right? Where all this terrible stuff happens, right? The monster gets revived. He kills some people. Igor has him take revenge for him. Dr. Frankenstein kind of goes off the deep end a bit, but the monster is killed. And then Dr. Frankenstein at the end is leaving town. He's like, oh, well, townspeople, I leave you the deed to my castle and jolly good. Goodbye, everyone. And everyone's laughing and happy. Like, you just like murdered a bunch of people here. And you this is not the, I just thought it was ridiculous.
Well, he didn't murder anyone. The monster murdered.
He facilitated the murder of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I don't know if that would hold up in a court of law, Josh.
I'm not even asking for a court of law. Obviously, the courts in this town are completely fucked because they will not even let Igor be arrested again. But just the whole concept of this movie, like we emphasize over and over and over again, the townspeople hate Frankenstein. They hate the name. They hate Wolf Frankenstein, even though he didn't do anything when he shows up. And then at the end, he's leaving and they're like, all is forgiven. We're good. It's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think also, you know, that's emblematic of a lot of movies of this time period. The story ends and then they're like, well, we got a button. We just got to end it with an end scene, even though the story's over. And the end scene doesn't always have to do with what we've just seen. It's just like, so long. See you later. Okay, bye. Mm-hmm. And then it's just the end on screen, right?
I feel like we could have just done without that scene. It would have, I mean, even to end abruptly on just the monster being destroyed would have been fine. Like, that's all we really need, you know?
I agree with you. Or you do the classic, you know, hand coming up from the tar pit and we end there or whatever.
Right. So, I did.
Sulfur pit.
I did think of the end of Terminator 2 when they lower them into the molten whatever, you know, in this here. But yeah, of course, we don't even need that because in the next movie, that's just like the monster is fine. You know, it's like, oh, the sulfur pit wasn't really that bad. It was no big deal.
Well, it's a health resort for the Romans, Josh.
Right. Yeah. He's been rejuvenated and ready to go and played by a different actor. So
that's right.
Should we rate this movie out of 5 Frankensteins?
Sure. 5 Frankensteins. It gets Frankensteins for me. No, 3 Frankensteins for me, Josh.
I'm going to give it 3.5 Frankensteins. Like I said, again, I enjoyed it more this time. I think if people think of this as a lesser one, it's worth checking out. So Dave, how would you rate this?
I'm going with 3, but it is fun and it is worth checking out for sure.
So we'll come back then and talk about the legacy of Son of Frankenstein. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1939, we are talking about our cult classic pick, Son of Frankenstein. And we've talked a bit about the franchise and how this kind of continued after the success of this film. Boris Karloff did decide to bow out, but that didn't stop them, of course. Ghost of Frankenstein was the next film in the Universal series. They brought in Lon Chaney Jr. as the Frankenstein monster, and Bela Lugosi did return as Igor. And then it kind of went into the crossover territory. We alluded to Marvel earlier, but this really is the first cinematic universe as Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman and all of these characters kind of intermingled in House of Frankenstein, and Frankenstein meets the Wolfman And then Abbott and Costello met Frankenstein, and et cetera, et cetera. And Bela Lugosi himself ended up on the other side of this, playing the Frankenstein monster in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Man, that's a lot of Frankensteins, Josh. One might say they Frankenstein this franchise together.
They did. They did indeed. But it is interesting to realize that, you know, we think of the Marvel as this innovative thing, and Universal was doing this with their monster movies back in the 30s and 40s.
Every time we say Lon Chaney, I just keep thinking I saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen doing the Werewolves of London. Mm. So that's where I'm at right now, Josh.
Yeah. Is that Edgar Winter? Or is that Johnny Winter? Or is that who does that?
No, that's a totally different. That's Werewolves of London. That's Warren Zevon.
Zevon. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I'm confusing my classic rockers here.
I mean, totally different styles. I'll have to get back to you on that, okay. Josh. Let's talk about some of the other Frankenstein movies we've watched, because we all kind of watch different things here, Josh. We mentioned Young Frankenstein. Got to mention Frankenweenie. That's a classic.
Yeah,
right?
I do Frank like Frankenweenie the dog. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I watched a movie, The Spirit of the Beehive from 1973, a Spanish movie from Spain, where Spanish movies are often made, Josh, about this little town. And the Frankenstein, the original James Whale movie, they come and they show it as like a roadshow picture. And then this little girl who watches the movie, she gets kind of lost in like the world. Like she becomes like, she seems to not be able to, well, she watches it. And then she kind of tells her sister that she can talk to Frankenstein. And then her sister gets kind of caught up in this world of like what's real and what's not real. It's very like kind of dreamlike. I didn't love it, but I know a lot of people do.
Yeah, that's definitely considered a classic film. And I haven't seen it, but I'm curious to see it. And it certainly is highly regarded. I'm a big fan. As I said, I love the Frankenstein novel. And I just, for whatever reason, I'm kind of fascinated with the Frankenstein story and all the permutations of it. And I was looking, I mean, depending on how you qualify, and there's a lot of movies that are sort of very loosely inspired by Frankenstein, but you know, depending on how you qualify it, I think I've seen more than 50 Frankenstein and Frankenstein related films. Hammer has a great Frankenstein series of, I think, 5 or 6 movies starring Peter Cushing as Dr. Frankenstein. I do like Frankenweenie, and you mentioned Young Frankenstein, and that, I mean, of course, is a parody of these Universal movies, but this movie, Son of Frankenstein, is really the main source for what Mel Brooks does in Young Frankenstein. You can really recognize a lot of it. There's a 1970s TV movie called Frankenstein, The True Story that I think is super underrated, really interesting take on it. And recently, in the last year or so, we've had a bunch of different sort of reimaginings of this, whether that's Lisa Frankenstein that was just out in theaters, or Poor Things, which of course is nominated for all these Oscars, a movie called Birth Rebirth that I really like. So that's just a handful. I mean, we could just go on and on. We could do a whole like series. You could do a podcast just about Frankenstein movies and have, you know, hundreds of episodes probably.
Would you call it Awesome Frankenstein here, or would you call it Frankenstein, Frankenstein, Frankenstein?
Well, that's clearly the title that you want. And then, I mean, Dave, I know you have become this huge Ken Russell fan, and his film Gothic is also a Frankenstein story.
Sure, absolutely. Just going back to the source of the story being written. It's great. It's so weird. And also a lot like Bride of Frankenstein in tone, but also Frankenhooker. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frankenhooker is something. All right. Yeah. It sure is. So, I mean, Boris Karloff, he did not play Frankenstein, or rather the monster, again after this, but he is this massive horror icon. I mean, playing that monster made him huge in, you know, the horror world. He also starred in The Mummy, The Old Dark House, The Black Cat, The Body Snatcher, all of these kind of classic horror movies, and went on to then lampoon his image in a couple of those Abbott and Costello meet the monster movies, including one called Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer Boris Karloff. So that's how famous he was. He got his name in the title. He played Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And he got a chance to be on the other side of this by playing Dr. Frankenstein much later in a film called Frankenstein 1970, which is not very good, but it's nice to see Karloff get the chance to play that character.
Josh, a few other things about, first of all, I want to give him credit, because I know we said like Lugosi overshadows him, but when he finds Igor dead and he like emotes just that scream. It's just awesome. He nails that right there. It's a really, really excellent performance that way. Wasn't he the voice of the Grinch? You won a Grammy for that.
Yeah, he was the voice of the Grinch. And I feel like that's, you know, there's a whole new generation that knows him specifically for that, which is, you know, perfect for him. Another kind of a monster in a way, you know, an iconic monster as much as the Frankenstein monster is.
Right. And did you ever read any of the comic books, the Boris Karloff's Tales of Mystery?
I did not. But I mean, I wonder, did he write those or did he just, I feel like it's like that Abbott and Costello thing.
Lended his
name. Yeah, he just lends his name. But no, I mean, he's always entertaining. And I've seen him in straight non-horror roles and, you know, especially earlier on in the 30s. And, you know, he can play this kind of debonair character or play like a gangster or whatever. You know, later in his career, he worked with Roger Corman in The Terror and The Raven and was in a bunch of B-movies. But just like one of the biggest figures in the world of horror for decades.
Yeah. Also performed under the name Karloff the Uncanny. What a cool name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bela Lugosi, of course, also a huge icon of horror. I mean, we talked in our episode about Glenn or Glenda, about his work with Ed Wood, which is in the sort of sad later part of his career. But in this era, huge part of all these Universal movies, of course, he played Dracula in the original Dracula. He's also in The Wolfman, plays Igor again in Ghost of Frankenstein. He plays the monster in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and then went back to playing Dracula in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. So he was all over these films.
What about The Black Cat or The Raven? You ever see those?
Yeah, I have seen both of those. The Raven, there's two versions. The one with Karloff and Lugosi, which is a 30s version. And then there's the Corman film with just Karloff from, I think, from the 60s. And I've seen both of them. They're very, very, very different films. But yeah, it's fun to see Karloff and Lugosi together in all these different contexts. And they clearly play off each other very well.
I agree with that, Josh. Your man, Basil Rathbone, played Sherlock Holmes. That's probably what he's most famous for. He was also Tybalt in Romeo and Juliet. He's in David Copperfield. He's got two Best Supporting Actor nominations and a Tony Award for Best Actor.
Yeah, I mean, even as many people have played Sherlock Holmes in, you know, the many, many decades, like, he is still, I think, one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known actor to have played Sherlock Holmes.
I think so. Josephine Hutchins. No offense, Robert Downey Jr. or Will Ferrell.
Yeah, especially Will Ferrell. That's a classic performance right there.
So, Josh, this is interesting. Josephine Hutchinson, who played Elsa, the Baroness, we've talked about her mom in this season. Do you remember what movie that was?
I remember because I looked it up and her mom is in Gone with the Wind.
Yes, Leona Roberts, Mrs. Mead, one of those fun Southern ladies. And Hutchinson was a big, you know, North by Northwest is what I think most people would know her for. But she had a ton of TV credits as well.
And we just talked a bit about Lionel Atwill in The Gorilla, and he was a very prolific actor. And what I found fascinating is, like Karloff and Lugosi, he was in a bunch of these Universal horror movies. He's in five of these movies playing a different character in each one.
That's great.
Yeah.
Donnie Dunnigan was the voice of Bambi, Josh.
Yeah, he was the voice of young Bambi. He only was in a handful of movies as a kid actor and then quit acting, had a whole career in the Marines. He's still alive, Donnie Dunnigan.
Wow.
Yeah. A big, you know, hey, thank you for your service, Donnie Dunnigan.
Yes.
Josh, a few other people. Lawrence Grant, who was the Burgermaster, hosted the fourth Oscars in 1931 and then was in pictures like The Mask of Fu Manchu and Shanghai Express, I'll Tell the World. So that's pretty cool. Tom Ricketts was in the first American film adaption of A Christmas Carol in 1908 and played Ebenezer Scrooge. And he was a director of one of the first movies ever made in Hollywood, Josh.
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing how, like, some of these people's careers stretch back to the earliest days of movies even being invented. Roland V. Lee, as we said, he was, you know, unlike James Whale, who was more of an auteur, he was kind of a journeyman director. He did a lot of B movies. And this was later in his career. He retired in 1945 to run a very successful ranch that was also a place where movies were filmed. And the only other film of his I've seen is a very, very weird movie called I Am Suzanne that I saw at the TCM Festival one year, about this creepy puppeteer who kind of becomes this, gets in a relationship with this woman and controls her in a very unsettling way. And it's one of these movies where, you think you know what movies from this era are like, but sometimes they can be really fucking weird. And that is one of them. So, but he's made a lot of other more conventional films that I have not seen.
Hey, Josh, two smaller parts. Ward Bond, he was Bert the Cop in It's a Wonderful Life, so it's cool to see him here, and Captain Clayton in The Searchers. And, of course, a cameo from Jim Thorpe, maybe the greatest American athlete of all time.
Who did he play?
He was a burger.
Oh, all right. Cool. I did not know that. Well, that's really extensive there. Is there anything else you want to say about the legacy of this film, Jason?
Fire bad.
That's not in this one, but it is a classic Frankenstein line.
Little Phil Hartman.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So that is Son of Frankenstein, and that is this episode of Awesome Movie Year. You can check us out on our reanimated web presence and social media.
Yeah, we're at awesomemovieyear.com, Awesome Movie Year on Facebook and Instagram, and I don't know why anyone is keeping X alive, but they are, much like the Frankenstein. So you can find us there on Awesome Movie Pod. I'm Jay Harris Comedy, or Jason Harris Comedy on all the things, and go for Jason on Letterboxd.
You can find some old stuff from me, including many, many, like 30 or more entries about Frankenstein movies at joshbellhateseverything.com. I'm at Josh Bell Hates Everything on Facebook, and at Signal Bleed on that resurrected X platform, as well as on Blue Sky and on Letterboxd. And if you're on Letterboxd and you watch one of the movies that we talk about, tag your review with Awesome Movie Year. We'd love to know what you think about this or any of the movies on our show. And you can listen to our producer, David Rosen's awesome podcast, Piecing It Together.
Check out Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find recent episodes on Lisa Frankenstein and Poor Things.
All right.
To this conversation, and search back for that Frankenstein one from the very first year of Piecing It Together. And follow us on social media at Piecing Pod.
Jason, what do we have in our next episode?
Josh, we left it up to the audience, didn't we?
We usually do.
Because it's the audience choice episode, and they had to choose between three comedy classics from different comedic icons. And they went with the Marx Brothers, At the Circus.
So tune in next time for At the Circus. And thanks for listening to Awesome Movie Year.
Thank you for listening to Awesome Movie Year. Make sure to follow Awesome Movie Year on Facebook, at Awesome Movie Pod on Twitter, and at Awesome Movie Year on Instagram. And if you like the show, review us and rate us with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
An All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.